Okay, it's nearly 3 o'clock. My name's Ann Fuller, and I'm hosting Juno Afternoon. We'll get a preview of tonight's presentation about life in the Gaza Strip. Ken Fix will be here to highlight this week's retro sci-fi film at the Planetarium. We'll talk about measles immunization opportunities. Weather today, it's sunny, increasing clouds tonight. Tuesday, rain. Wednesday, rain.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The buzz across Indian country last week was President Obama's trip to the Standing Rock Reservation. Charles Michael Ray reports on Friday's visit to Cannonball, North Dakota.
President Barack Obama's speech to a crowd of about 1,800 began with an attempt to reach across the language barrier.
I'm going to try something in Lakota, but, you know, I can't guarantee it's going to come out perfect. How mi dako yepi?
The president's effort to greet the crowd in Lakota brought cheers and applause. He aims to improve economic development on places like Standing Rock. He announced plans to remove some of the bureaucratic and regulatory barriers that many say have limited positive economic development in Indian country. And he's promising to increase tribal self-governance over land issues. This includes a new training program that aims to help tribal residents in efforts to own a home or commercial building on tribal lands.
Creating more jobs and supporting small businesses in places like Standing Rock. Because young people should be able to live and work and raise a family right here in the land of your fathers and mothers.
The president's visit to Indian country also includes a focus on educating the next generation of tribal residents. His plans call for more local control over education, increased internet access and technology improvements, more student aid, and more support for maintaining tribal languages. The president and first lady met with a number of local young people.
I love these young people. I only spent an hour with them. They feel like my own. And you should be proud of them, because they've overcome a lot, but they're strong and they're still standing and they're moving forward.
President Obama's plans aim to bring an equality of opportunity for Native children. Obama finished his address at Standing Rock with some words of encouragement.
And every day that I have the honor of serving as your president, I will do everything I can to make sure that you see that our country has a place for everyone, including every single young person here, and all across the Dakotas, and all across America, and that you're getting the support and encouragement you need to go as far as your hard work and your talent will take you. That is my commitment to you, to every single young person here.
Mr. Obama's message aims to reinforce the idea that the opportunities in Indian country outweigh the current challenges. He left Standing Rock via helicopter and boarded Air Force One a short time later. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Native language revitalization efforts are underway in California, and Ann Hoffman reports on a recent conference.
American Indians from all over California gathered at UC Berkeley to talk about how to keep their languages alive. Matthew Vestuto came down from Oregon.
Haku haku tsamtanet masachihwa ka Matthew Vestuto noak chumash kasnuna mitskanakan. Greetings, my name is Matthew Vestuto. I'm Chumash from Ventura, California.
Vestuto has been learning his ancestral language from old recordings and documents that were made back when there were still native speakers. The Breath of Life conference brings people like Vestuto together with professional linguists. Nicole Smith is here to study Pomo and runs a language program in Northern California.
There's just been a lot of shame. You know, back when I was younger, about 15 years ago, nobody was speaking the language, not in public anyway.
This conference keeps growing and has inspired similar events in Washington, D.C. and Oklahoma. I'm Ann Hoffman.
Canadians observe National Aboriginal Day in June to celebrate First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by Sacred Wind Community Connect, providing scholarships and internet training to the Navajo Nation and Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. Sacred Wind believes broadband can reinforce Native cultures and offer means for self-determination. SacredWindCommunications.com. Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of June, 2014. Today is Bloom's Day, celebrating that day in 1904 that James Joyce wrote his novel Ulysses about Leopold Bloom, the protagonist, who lives an ordinary day in Dublin. He buys kidneys at the butcher's, serves his wife Molly breakfast in bed, he reads the mail, visits the outhouse, goes to a funeral in the morning, runs an errand at the drugstore, inadvertently gives a man a winning tip about a racehorse, he bumps into an old girlfriend, he stops off for a sandwich and a glass of wine, helps a blind man across the street, ducks into a museum to avoid his wife's lover, gets into an argument at Barney Kiernan's pub, ogles a young woman at the beach, and pays a hospital visit to a woman in the throes of childbirth, spends the evening in a red-light district with young Stephen Dedalus, for whom Mr. Bloom feels a paternal connection, and sees the young man home safely, and finally, in the wee hours, he comes back home to Molly. It's the birthday of Joyce Carol Oates, born in Lockport, New York, 1938, the author of more than 70 books, including Because It Is Bitter and Because It Is My Heart and We Were the Mulvaneys. Joyce Carol Oates, who said, "I think all art comes out of conflict. When I write, I am always looking for the dramatic kernel of an event, the junctures of people's lives when they go in one direction and not another." It was on this day in 1858, Abraham Lincoln, running for the Senate, gave a speech in Springfield, Illinois, urging that the issue of slavery be resolved once and for all, a speech in which he said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And it's the birthday of the historian Lucy Davidovich, born in New York City, 1915. Parents, Polish immigrants, raised their daughters as secular Jews. Davidovich didn't attend a Jewish service until she was in her 20s. But with the rise of the Nazis in Germany, she decided to focus on Jewish history. Studied in Poland at the Institute for Jewish Research just before the Nazis invaded Poland, came back to this country, and wrote numerous books about the Holocaust, including The War Against the Jews, which came out in 1975. Lucy Davidovich wrote, "Some people think that the professional historian's personal commitments to his people, his country, his religion, his language undermine his professional objectivity. Not so. As long as historians respect the integrity of their sources and adhere strictly to the principles of sound scholarship, personal commitments do not distort, but instead they enrich historical writing." Here's a poem for today by Theodore Rethke, Vernal Sentiment. "Though the crocuses poke up their heads in the usual places, the frog scum appear on the pond with the same froth of green, and boys moon at girls with last year's fatuous faces, I never am bored, however familiar the scene. When from under the barn the cat brings a similar litter, two yellow and black, and one that looks in between, though it all happened before, I cannot grow bitter. I rejoice in the spring as though no spring ever had been." Theodore Rethke's poem Vernal Sentiment from the collected poems of Theodore Rethke, published by Anchor Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Keeler. And on Juno Afternoon, we're here to get an overview of a talk tonight called Life in the Gaza Strip. Hello, Haytham.
Hello.
Haytham Mohanna has been living in Haines and going to high school there, but his home is in Gaza. And so tonight he's going to be speaking to folks who want to come to Northern Light United Church and listen to him. I wanted to ask you about whether, did you find high school different in Haines than it had been at home?
Well, yeah, for sure. Like, back in Gaza, it's kind of, the education system is kind of different than in Haines or the American system. Back in Gaza, I'm in Christian school, and so I'm with girls in the same class, but in Gaza Strip, we have two shifts, and we have different school for each gender. So we have for a school for boys and school for girls, and each gender. Also, the education system is kind of different. We don't have elective choices. We can't, like, really choose which subject. We can choose about the subjects. And the GPA, like, maybe here in the GPA is from 4 or 4.0,
right.
But back in Gaza is from 100. Which kind of different, yeah. We have the same thing, the same years, 12 years. Here in Haines, it's kind of more flexible. It's kind of small because it Haines, like, just 87 people. Back in Gaza, it's way more. These may be the major difference between the education back here in Gaza.
Thank you for explaining that. Yes, I should think that. And where you live at home, I think it's in a more of a city neighborhood than this edge of the woods like Haines.
Well, we didn't have forest and trees. Like, we didn't have really that space to live in and that view even. Like, here, it's the first time I see mountains. So it's kind of way different, you know. back in Gaza, it's kind of crowded. Here you see it has space. But, yeah.
All right. Well, and you got to see snow and do all those wintry things. But we're not going to talk about winter. I'd like to ask you what you're going to talk about tonight.
Well, tonight in the church, I'm going to talk how usually I live back in Gaza and how we, the different worlds live. Because many Americans, that it's kind of doesn't know about the other world of the... And here's my kind of goal of coming here as an ambassador and let the people know more about my country and how I live and how the difficulties that we usually have every day, electricity, the water, the many things, you know. It's not just about one thing and you just go for it or just difficulties. We have lots of things going on, and nowadays it's more difficult, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to go back because there's, like, borders are closed, so many things going on and always stressful. So I'm in the speech I'm going to give tonight, it's going to be how I live, let people know more and let them be more open-minded in our world in the Gaza Strip.
That sounds great. I think that it is intriguing to hear someone from a different place, as you say, you know, no forests, and it happens all around the world, but it sounds like you're going to structure it to be, but we're people, we do what people do, we go to school, we shop, this is what we do. And it sounds like it should be fascinating. Have you been giving this talk? Did you give this talk up in Haines, too?
In the first of the year when I came here, I did a talk. Mm-hmm. And really, there was a good talk. Like, more than 70 people attended that talk. And it was really good. Also, I give a gift to school, which is a peacock, a different one than I'd give to that legislature here. Mm-hmm. But I did in Haines, yeah.
All right. Well, it does sound to me as though you feel comfortable with your subject and that it's an important thing to share with people. Tell me more about this peacock, because I think it's a very elaborate
paper really,
sculpture.
Like, if I did by we did two ones. The first one I did by myself, all of it. And it was really hard because cutting the paper cutting the mm-hmm. right size, it took me like 2 weeks just cutting the paper. And after that, it took me 2 months just folding it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 16 hours putting it all together.
Right.
And then I gave it to school as a gift for me. And the other one, we did it with the Thunder Mountain High School students. And I came here to Juneau and I teach them how to do it. And they start folding it, the paper. And then I went back Haines, and after a couple months, I came back and we put it all together. And
right.
That was kind of fun. And we give it as a gift to the legislature.
Right, that's the one I saw. We saw pictures of that. It looked just beautiful, and by sharing the work, it got done again. Have you seen yet here in Juneau, people have been folding cranes? There's an event coming up in July, and so in our library display space now, there's long chains of origami cranes.
Oh, well, no, I never.
So, paper folding seems to be what people are doing this year. Well, I think that you've told us about what you're going to be talking about, and then I'm sorry to hear about the questions about going home and borders. Let's think about, I hope you've had a great time in Haines, and that people will come out tonight. This is Haytham Mohana. He lives in the Gaza Strip, and except for this year that he's just spent in Haines. He'll be speaking tonight at Northern Light United Church, downtown, 7 o'clock. Come on out and listen to him. It's 3:19, and you're listening to K2FM. The Juneau 4th of July parade entry forms are available at the Mendenhall Library in the Valley and Cycle Alaska in town. Pick one up, fill it out, attach the entry fee, return to the same place you picked it up. And new this year is a category of vehicles called watercraft. That might be a boat, a ski-doo, an inner tube, a life jacket. Check the rules and regulations for dimensions of all entries. But it's good to be thinking ahead. 4th of July is coming. And also coming up in our town, we have a retro science fiction film series going on. Ken Fix, hello there.
Hi. Nice to be on this side of the microphone for a bit. I'm on your side tomorrow.
Okay. Well, today you're the guest, and I want you to tell us about what's going on at the planetarium.
Well, about four summers ago, I started running the Retro Sci-Fi Movie Program. And when I was originally volunteering with a group over at the planetarium, I asked them, well, what goes on in the summertime? And they said, well, basically nothing. And I said, well, why? We've got this huge space and nobody's using it, and we should do something to keep interest going in the planetarium year-round to have something going on at least once a month. And they said, yeah, we agree. What do you want to do? And I was like, well, why don't we run cheesy sci-fi movies? And we started running them from the 50s and the 60s, and we ran things like The Day the Earth Stood Still and This Island Earth and Them and Fantastic Voyage and Planet of the Apes. So that takes you through a couple of summers. Well, this is probably my last summer here in Juneau, so I decided it was time to pull out my guilty pleasure movies.
Well, now that sounds like a slightly different category.
Okay, guilty pleasures would be something like if you're thumbing through the channels on TV and you come across nothing that you want to watch, and suddenly you arrive at a movie that's very familiar to you, and you think, well, there's nothing else really worthwhile watching. I'm just going to jump in from here to wherever the end is. And you do that. Well, those three movies that fit that category this summer are Deep Impact, which we're running in August, Galaxy Quest, which we're running in July, and our feature for tomorrow night, which is Independence Day. It's not truly a classic yet, but it's 18 years old. It was made in 1996.
So do you hold with the like antique cars if 25 years makes it classic, or are you going for 35 years to be classic?
Well, actually 20
would
qualifies
be good.
Something as a classic, but I'm running stuff that's, you know, at least a few years old, but they're still really good movies and very entertaining. And Independence Day was one of my favorites. I always jump into that one if I see it showing on cable or whatnot. You know, and just, oh, wow, that's on. Well, I just jumped in here from where it is to the end. So I would say I've seen the ending at least three times as many times as I've seen the beginning of the movie, at least.
Sounds like a good excuse for putting it on the series. You'll be there at the beginning this
time,
though.
Although I don't want people arriving in the middle of the movie. It starts tomorrow night at 6:30, and the movie's just over 2 hours, so it's probably going to run to about 8:45 before everybody gets out of there. But like all of our shows at the Planetarium, it's free to the public, and it's the only time in the year where we actually get to use the Planetarium sound system. Believe it or not, it has a very good sound system. It was installed in 1968 with several speakers, and I'm able to just jack the laptop projection right into the sound system and play it through. So it's sort of like, you know, kind of like a drive-in atmosphere without the cars, and we encourage people to bring their lawn chairs, blankets, whatever have you. It's a very relaxed atmosphere, even though we do have plenty of chairs in the planetarium. You can bring pretty much whatever you want to sit on or make yourself comfortable.
That sounds great. And then you beam it up and play it on the dome?
Correct. Yeah, it goes right on the Star Dome. You know, so you're looking up just a little bit, but it's not like straight overhead.
No.
So it's really nice. It's usually cool in there. It rarely gets hot in there. That's the biggest problem in the winter times. You have to turn on heaters. But it's just something to keep the interest going in the planetarium. And, of course, you know, we accept donations like we do for every show. And there are concessions for sale. So we will have popcorn and candy and bottled water. No other drinks are allowed because if we spill something, the water at least dries up, or if it's pop or something like that, it creates a whole other problem.
I see. Now, let's talk about the planetarium a little bit. The planetarium is located downtown next to Juneau Douglas High School. It depends on how long you've been
Correct.
In town, which
so
building
the
you
Marie
think
Drake
it is.
Middle School building is what
right.
it used to be, but I don't know what they're calling it now. Just the Marie Drake building, I guess.
Okay.
But yeah, for people coming from the Valley, If you're coming down Egan Highway, you make the left turn where the breakwater is. You make the right turn, and you're going parallel to the schools. You'll see a bunch of fences. As soon as the fences stop, the sidewalk that goes in is to the Marie Drake Middle School building. And if you went past the Blockbuster video, you went too far.
Excellent directions. I love the direction you're coming, what you see, and turn around if you get to Blockbuster. Because you don't need Blockbuster tomorrow night. You've got this film.
No, you don't. You get this. And it's for free. And, we encourage everybody to come out and watch it. I'm actually hoping for terrible weather. Forecast did say it was going to be rainy. So I'm actually hoping it's different from tonight. And I get a pretty good turnout. And everybody has a good time.
That sounds like a great wish. The planetarium... You said, I think, that it started in 1968?
Yes. It's the largest planetarium in Alaska. It's bigger than the one in Anchorage. Our dome is larger than the one that's in Anchorage. And we're still using a 1968 vintage Spitz Starball projector. It was manufactured in Pennsylvania. And we're still nursing that thing along, but ideally we're looking for grants and public support so that we can get a digital Starball, which will allow us to replace the aging Spitz analog Starball, and also bring up programs from other planetariums, and we could just run them on our system because everybody's kind of on the same system.
I see. So things have modernized and standardized since that was installed. So I think that originally there was a school teacher involved.
Yes, there was. He left in, I believe, the... early 1980s, he was done, and the planetarium had gone into just vacant room. It was at one point made into a computer room. Then it was used for storage, and volunteers came in the early 90s and asked if they could sort of take over the operation, and the school district let him do just that. So it's been in the hands of volunteers ever since.
And so it's a wonderful... tiny institution, a resource for our town. And this idea of come watch a movie, find your way to the planetarium, because what's up in space is fascinating.
Well, this is, it's a pretty good blockbuster at the time. It was the biggest box office grossing movie in 1996. Ultimately, it brought in almost $1 billion worldwide, an initial production cost of about $75 million, which was pretty big for a summer tentpole movie, even back then in 96. And it's also the first movie that used advertising in the Super Bowl, a tactic that a lot of other motion picture companies have copied since. So they put ad spots in that early in February for a movie that wasn't coming out until July. But that was, getting the interest going in it, and also very little in the way of computer-generated effects. Almost everything was done in camera with miniatures and actual explosions because they thought it lent an air of realism to it versus using the computer-generated graphics that a lot of movies use today.
Well, so it's an interesting movie.
Yeah, you get to see them blow up the White House, too. It was a 10-foot model with about 40 different explosive charges rigged on it, and they blew the whole thing up. And they'd actually used previous sets. There was still a set that they had for a movie called The American President, which Michael Douglas starred in. And they used that for a lot of the interior White House scenes. So it's a case of some things fell right into place with them, and they were able to use existing sets. They did a lot of work with establishing shots. They got most of the actors fairly cheap. And now there's talk about doing a second movie, which will come out in the summer of 2016. But right now, Will Smith wants a little too much money for the next movie, so I don't think they're going to get him. But most everybody else is pretty well signing on for it.
All right. And so this would be our chance to see it on a large screen?
Yes, your chance to see it projected, pretty big size, with decent sound and a bunch of friends and popcorn and whatnot. So, yeah, it's actually really good.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ken, for coming in to talk about the planetarium. We're talking about the film series, and this month's film is Independence Day. It shows tomorrow night, Tuesday the 17th, at 6:30.
Correct.
Admission is free. The volunteers will be there to sell concessions or accept donations, and it's at the planetarium downtown. Anything more to say?
No, come on out, everybody, especially if it's raining.
Great.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Woke up this morning, I was feeling quite weird. Had flies in my beard, my toothpaste was smeared. Over my window, they'd written my name. Said, so long, we'll see you again. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
Next, a story from Pete Griffin, the Storytelling Ranger. Pete lives here in Juneau, and the story is Talks with Wolves.
A friend and I were pulling Dungeness crab pots in a remote bay near Ketchikan, Alaska, on one of those fall days when a cold, rainy drizzle turns into ice pellets. We stacked the pots in the skiff and debated whether or not to make the 20-mile run back home in the sleet with our bucket of crabs or to go ashore and build a fire. As we sat in the skiff discussing the situation, we heard a low moan come from the woods, a moan that rose in volume, continuing for about 10 seconds. Norm and I looked at each other and grinned. We had just heard a wolf howl. They say wolves howl as a means of communicating with other wolves. Nobody has ever interviewed the wolves to ask them why. It seems like howling is a way for packs to call each other to the site of a kill, or a way for wolves to bond together, or a way for one wolf pack to let the others know about territorial boundaries. But I learned that this tendency to howl is useful in another way. As a wildlife biologist, I transferred from the Huron-Manistee National Forest in Michigan to the Chippewa National Forest in northern Minnesota in 1987. There I had responsibilities for wildlife recreation and fire. Unlike Michigan, there were wolves on the Chippewa. There was a pack to the north that expanded its range onto my district each winter in search of food. We would see occasional wolf tracks out in the woods and every once in a while hear about a wolf sighting. Employees would report to me that they'd seen one of my wolves. When our district reorganized how work was going to be accomplished, I suggested that we hire a new full-time wildlife biologist to work with the folks in timber management. I'd found out there was far more work than I could reasonably do well. Because timber cutting had the greatest effect on wildlife habitat, I figured we needed a full-time biologist working directly with the forester on the district. I was willing to give up that role for which I'd been schooled and trained in order for the district to improve its wildlife management program. So we hired Paul, a young man with a Ph.D. in wildlife who had extensive experience outside the agency. After a couple of years, we started getting regular reports of wolf sightings during the summer and more frequent stories about pets disappearing from backyards. We needed to find a way to take stock of the wolf population, so our new biologist, Paul, devised a howling survey to locate wolf packs. It wasn't a one-man job. It was going to take a lot of help. Now, the way he went about this was to take our folks to the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota, to be trained in the art of howling. All of our employees, foresters, recreation managers, timber sale administrators, business managers, and even the district ranger learned how to howl and how to interpret wolf howls they might receive in return. On a late summer evening, small teams of employees fanned out across the district to predetermined locations. Well after dark, we would throw back our heads, cup our hands around our mouths, and cut loose with howls. Not Hollywood movie wolf howls, but a less musical effort, a long, loud monotone. Ooh. Followed by two more howls just like the first, then we would wait for answers. If we heard nothing for several minutes, we would repeat ourselves and wait again. If we heard nothing after the second howl, we would go on to the next stop on our planned route. To tell you the truth, I was a bit skeptical. After my first two stops, there was no response. At the third, my companion and I howled once, twice, and then from the dark woods at the end of the gravel road, only 100 yards away, came an answer. A howl from a wolf, then quickly joined by a second. It was enough to raise the hair on the back of my neck. In the wee hours of the morning, we gathered to compare results. That night, our crews had heard 4 or 5 wolf packs. They were enthused, especially our employees in timber management who had never before been asked to help in the wildlife program. One of them described being on a darkened lakeshore at midnight in the hot, humid night air, not a breath of wind, surrounded by the steady drone of mosquitoes. On the far side of the lake, from a small community in the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, the beat of the drums from a Chippewa tribe celebration drifted in. The crew howled, and wolves howled back at them. Our folks felt like they'd been sent back in time 200 years to the dawn of the 19th century when voyageurs paddled the waters of Indian country, trapping and trading with the Chippewa people. Howling for wolves was an unforgettable experience for us that night. I learned a couple of things. I had given up being the wildlife biologist, something I loved doing, and turned it over to another person. But Paul had come up with a project that I was unlikely to have initiated. He had drawn all of our employees into the effort, and in doing so, they were no longer the wildlife biologist's wolves, they were our wolves. And it also made me realize that if the Forest Service was going to manage ecosystems, we couldn't parcel out pieces of the forest management program exclusively to any one set of resource specialists. The wolves didn't care whether it was a forester, a wildlife biologist, or an engineer who was hauling at them. Our goal was the understanding that every one of us was responsible for the whole ecosystem and not just one part. We had taken the first big step toward achieving that goal. It's interesting what you can learn from talking to wolves.
I'm Jordan Nigro, and I'm a sustaining member of K2. I have listened to K2 my entire life. I grew up in Gustavus, so I think I was listening to K2 in the womb. Becoming a member felt sort of like a rite of passage and becoming a member of the community. It's not about the amount, it's about the connection.
Connect and contribute at ktoo.org.
This is Bird Note. Perhaps as much as any man, Henry David Thoreau enjoyed his walks in the woods. In June 1853, Thoreau wrote in his journal of an enchanting encounter with the wood thrush. The wood thrush launches forth his evening strains from the midst of the pines. I admire the moderation of this master. There is nothing tumultuous in his song. He launches forth one strain with all his heart and life and soul, of pure and unmatchable melody, and then he pauses and gives the hearer and himself time to digest this, and then another, and another. About a week later, Thoreau wrote again of the wood thrush, "This is the only bird whose note affects me like music. It lifts and exhilarates me. It is inspiring. It changes all hours to an eternal morning." Wood thrushes thrive in large expanses of forest, and their numbers have declined as forests have been cut on their breeding grounds and where they winter, in southern Mexico and Central America. Yet nearly half of wood thrush pairs have two broods per nesting season, so given a chance, their numbers could rebound. Protected areas like Adirondack Park, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and Ozark National Forest give them that chance. Today's show is brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. I'm Michael Stein.
The clinic is closed and you or a loved one don't feel well, or you have a health-related question that can't wait. What do? Here's the solution. Starting July 1st, Search will have a free after-hours nurse triage line for our patients in Juneau. Search's free after-hours service is available by calling 1-800-613-0560. For life-threatening emergencies, please call 911.
This message brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
It's 3:41. My name's Ann Fuller. I'm hosting Juneau Afternoon today. Chastity, welcome to the station.
Thank you.
And Sarah, good to see you.
Thank you. You too.
And these nurses are here from the Juneau Public Health Center to talk about measles immunizations. So what are some of the details, Sarah?
Okay. Well, thank you for your time today. We're here to talk to you about the importance of measles vaccination. Measles outbreaks have hit a record 15-year high in the lower 48, and while we haven't seen any cases yet in Alaska, we know with the tourist season upon us, that is a risk. So we are emphasizing the importance of immunization, particularly for our most vulnerable citizens, our children in particular. Chastity here can tell us a little bit about the schedule for the immunizations for measles.
Well, we recommend that the series begin between the ages of 12 and 15 months, and then children get a second follow-up booster between the ages of 4 years and 6 years.
All right. And so those are the suggestions. And measles are one of the ones that show up for getting into school?
Yes, it is a requirement for school.
All right. So but if you get it done beforehand, you get your little card, you get it stamped.
You're all set.
And then you know you've gotten that shot.
Right. So it's really important also, since so many of us are traveling outside of Alaska, because they have seen so much in the lower 48, that if you're going to airports, you're traveling to other states, you are at a higher risk of exposure, because they are seeing those outbreaks in 18 different states now, that measles is highly contagious. And so if you have not been fully immunized, you are at risk for catching it, even in a limited exposure setting. So even just passing someone in an airport who has a case of measles, if you're not immune, you have a 90% chance of catching that disease.
Highly contagious.
Highly contagious. 90%.
Yeah. And the danger with that is many folks, before they present with the rash or with symptoms, are all contagious about 4 days before even the onset of a cough or cold type of symptom. So you can walk past someone contagious and not be aware.
Right. You wouldn't even see it. And the Public Health Service, Public Health Center, is located at Twin Lakes, Can everybody come to you to get their shots, or should we go to our own doctors, or how does that work?
A little bit of both. We can see any child under the age of 3, regardless of their insurance status, and we can immunize them based on a sliding fee schedule. We will never turn anyone away for inability to pay. Children older than 3 can be immunized with our state-supplied vaccine if they meet certain criteria, if they're Medicaid eligible, if they're Alaska Native, we're happy to immunize them. We have special funding for that through the federal government. If you have insurance, it's great to check in with your local doctor and make sure that you're up to date on your immunizations. Also, teens and adults who have not had two doses of the measles vaccine should also talk to their providers to make sure that they can get that second dose and be fully immune.
So we said this was measles immunization opportunity, and it
That's
certainly
right.
sounds like it. There's we try to schedule children at just over a year old and then a later booster. And if you're not sure, check your records, check with your doctor. And at the Public Health Center, if that's where people decide to go, should they call ahead to find a time that
would
shots
be great.
Are being given?
That would be great. We're at 465-3353, and you can schedule an appointment, or you can just ask to speak with a nurse, and we can see if we can help you out and find your records and look at them for you.
Excellent. I had not heard this about so much of measles cases coming in other places. And yes, here in Juneau in the summertime with us going out and people coming in, mm-hmm. We're not just isolated in our
nope.
own little part of the forest. So it's a good time to remind people to get those vaccinations. And nowadays, you were saying that we haven't had many cases in Juneau?
We haven't had any in Juneau. No, we haven't mm-hmm. seen any in Alaska yet.
All right.
But, you know, we are part of that bigger picture, so.
And I must admit, I was thinking, when I was growing up, we kind of routinely got rashes and various things that we called various stages of measles. But things have changed in 50 years, 60 years. Can you give us just a rundown of the symptoms and what the disease called measles is really?
Sure.
Well, measles is a rash. You get a rash that goes from head to toe. You also, the kids will develop a fever, cough, definitely congestion, and they'll also develop, their eyes might get watery, they get conjunctivitis. Also with measles, which is something that's pretty specific to measles. So if you see all of that combination in a person, you know that that's a good indication that it's measles.
I see.
If you have a high fever and a rash, definitely call your provider and get it checked out.
Okay. And the Public Health Center is one place you can call to start with. And we're urging people to make sure their measles shots are up to date. And while you're at it, there's some other vaccines to think about, too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Chastity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
care about keeping our community healthy. Please help us keep our trails, beaches, parks, and streets litter-free.
Recycle, use trash bins, and pack out your own trash. When you see litter, pick it up and throw it away.
Let's work together to keep Juno beautiful.
Thank you!
Love to take photos? We love photos, and we want to see yours. Why not share them with KTOO and maybe win a bag of Heritage Coffee? Send your photos to share@ktoo.org with the subject line, Photo of the Day. Please include the photographer's name and a description of where and when the photo was taken. Each day, we'll post the best submissions on Facebook, and the photo with the most likes that week wins a bag of coffee. More details at ktoo.org/photo.
Want to remind folks that tonight at 7 o'clock on K2, on Peace Talk, Phil Smith is talking with playwright Dave Hunsaker about his new play. The play is called Warriors. It's part of Perseverance Theater's Summer Fest. For the weather, tonight is mostly clear then increasing clouds late. Tuesday, rain, heavy at times. Wednesday, also rain. And Jeff Brown handed me a note. He says, interested in music? Would you like to share your enthusiasm with KRNN's listeners? We're looking for volunteer announcers to host a variety of radio programs. Don't worry if you don't have experience. We'll train you. If you've always wanted to be on the air, give Jeff Brown a call, 463-6425, or email him at jeff@k2.org. Thanks. Tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, it's Tuesday, and Ken Fix will host. We'll talk with Bill Diebolt about Tuesday's Essential Tremors Support Group meeting. Carol Biggs will be here to highlight her nature walks. We'll talk with Dove Gartenberg about the NAMI family-to-family sessions being held this summer. Sanjay Pierre will be here to talk about hiking with a scientist, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. That'll be Tuesday, 3 o'clock on K2. If you missed Juno Afternoon or want to hear it again, find it on the local programs link on the homepage, k2.org. And this week is Pride Week. There are films at Goldtown Nickelodeon through the week and several evening events starting tonight with Kickoff Kickball.